In February 2020, Sir Simon Jenkins delivered a programme on BBC Radio 4 entitled Wales, a 20th Century Tragedy. In attempting to discern how it was that Wales had gone from being relatively wealthy at the beginning of the century and a magnet for migrants, and to becoming one of the more economically deprived parts of Britain, he hit upon an interesting point. This was that the most successful Welshmen in the period tended to leave to make their fortunes in London, and then rarely ever returned. The most obvious example he cited was David Lloyd George, who only really settled back in his native land when death approached in old age. There are notable exceptions to this, though. One such was Dr. Thomas Jones. Rumney at the turn of the 20th century was a typical valley town. It had grown exponentially through the course of the previous 50 or so years with the rise of the ironworks, coal mines and the construction of a railway. This had drawn in tens of thousands of migrant workers from England, Ireland and North Wales. The Rumney Iron Company, the largest local employer, specialised in railways and exported as far afield as Germany, the United States and China. It dominated the town by building houses for its workers, shops for their convenience, a church and a brewery. To modern ears this may sound quite extraordinary, but it was a common story of towns across the coalfield at that time. One of those many workers drawn in by this was David Jones, a builder's son from Llangytho in Cardiganshire. In many ways it was truly an unexceptional story of life in South Wales at that time. A young man had migrated to take advantage of the great opportunities afforded to him by industrialisation. He'd been taken on by the big local company, and David, who was a Welsh speaker with a poor grasp of English, met his wife, Mary Ann Jones. They married in 1869, and on the 27th of September 1870, had the first of their 9 children, Thomas. Mary's father, Enoch, was in charge of the company-owned shops in the town, a staunch member and deacon of the Ebenezer Calvinistic Methodist Chapel, and, prestigiously for the time, a home owner. Related to such a figure, David rose to become a grocer's assistant and then, in short order, manager of the company shops. The stores, akin to modern supermarkets, sold everything from food and clothing to furniture and even coffins. In short, they had a monopoly in the town. Rising to the top of them entailed a large pay rise for David, who invested it in taking Thomas out of the local board school to send him to the fee-paying Lewis School in Pengham, further down the valley. And though the young Thomas showed academic flair, Enoch, who was determined to temper his grandson's bookish nature with the experience of the real world, insisted that he leave age 14 to become a clerk at the ironworks. Despite this, Thomas's academic side shone through, and he made a name for himself as a preacher in chapel. By 1890, he had won the prestigious Calvinist Methodist Scripture Gold Medal and was preparing to head to the University College of Wales, Aberystwyth, to study for ministry. This was not to be so, and becoming more agnostic in his faith and with other interests interfering, he did not graduate until 1901. And then it was from the University of Glasgow with a first in economics. In leaving his hometown, his biographer E.L. Ellis noted that though Jones later appeared to be authentically Whitehall on top, he remained stubbornly Rumney underneath. During his time in Glasgow, well on the way to becoming the city of the Red Clyde side, Jones found himself increasingly distracted from his studies by politics. First, he joined Keir Hardie's nascent independent Labour Party, and soon after founded the local branch of the Fabian Society. He combined this with charitable work in the slums, and like many of that persuasion, placed great faith in the ability of politics to relieve the suffering of the poor. In his inconclusive time at Aberystwyth, Jones had met Irene Lloyd, the daughter of a Liverpool University academic. Keeping up their correspondence, on the 31st of December 1902, they were married. It was a relationship that gave him great personal satisfaction, almost entirely without discord, and became the bedrock of his later career. They went on to have 3 children, 2 sons, Tristan, who would go on to become the manager of the Observer newspaper, and Alfin, who died in 1928 in a tragic motoring accident. They also had a daughter, Irene, who became a Labour MP and Under Secretary of State at the Colonial Office under Harold Wilson. Having become an agnostic, but with a strong belief in the ethical values that Christianity imbued and a true nonconformist in despising alcohol for the rest of his life, he opted for an academic career. In 1899, he had been a part-time assistant teaching political economy at Glasgow. Then, on graduation, he became a full-time lecturer, with a focus on those political issues that particularly took his interest, including unemployment and juvenile labour. During this period, he also became a special commissioner in Scotland for the Royal Commission into the Poor Law. And between 1904 and 1905, became Barrington Visiting Lecturer in Ireland, which required him to deliver around 50 lectures in various small towns across the Emerald Isle in the holidays. This frenzy of activity was not enough, though, and he considered applying to become principal of Ruskin College, Oxford, and Labour candidate for Meirionnydd in the 1906 general election. With all of this coming to nothing, he was appointed first Professor of Political Economy at Queen's University, Belfast, in 1909. Here again, having uprooted his family, he threw himself into other causes, including founding the local branch of the Workers' Educational Association. It was a sign of his later commitment to adult education as a way to encourage democratic engagement, and so, as a Fabian, he hoped, allowed for the rise of gradualist socialism through the ballot box. He still remained interested in the cultural and civic life of his native South Wales, and in 1910 was offered the secretaryship of the King Edward VII National Memorial Association to combat tuberculosis. The association had been founded by Montgomeryshire Liberal MP and millionaire businessman David Davis. Unlike many other coal mine owners in the region, such as Lord Rother, who Jones particularly disliked, Davis had invested his vast wealth in a series of philanthropic endeavours that Jones greatly admired. Relocating back to Wales, he added the secretaryship of the Welsh National Insurance Commission to his portfolio in 1912. This had been established by the new Liberal government to administer its health insurance scheme in Wales. All of this was part of that increasingly specifically Welsh national consciousness in the first decades of the last century, contemporaneous, for instance, with the founding of the National Library at Aberystwyth in 1911. That same year, Davis took him as part of a delegation to 11 Downing Street to meet the Chancellor of the Exchequer, David Lloyd George. Undoubtedly the most famous Welshman of his generation, Lloyd George had made a name for himself as a radical and the pioneer of the 1909 People's Budget, was impressed by Jones's arguments for the inclusion of paying for TB sanatoria in legislation. This began the start of a fruitful relationship in which Lloyd George increasingly called on Jones for advice on Welsh matters. By 1915 they were close friends, and Jones, or TJ as he began to be called in Whitehall, saw the so-called Welsh Wizard's radicalism as the best way to improve the lot of the common people. It also consolidated his friendship with Davis, who now put up the money for the founding of a new journal, The Welsh Outlook, in 1914. With Jones as its first editor, it took a progressively liberal and culturally nationalistic tone. He was especially critical of Lord Rother and the other coal mine owners for their treatment of their employees. But it never really made an impact outside elite circles. Jones, who called Davis the chief, went with him when Lloyd George asked Davis to become his parliamentary private secretary at the War Office in 1916. When Lloyd George, who TJ had long felt was the only politician capable of winning the First World War, became Prime Minister, Jones was given a position in his secretariat. This body, the forerunner of the Cabinet Office, was headed by civil servant Sir Maurice Hankey, and Lloyd George ensured that TJ became his deputy, with a focus on domestic affairs in line with TJ's own interests. Jones was regularly called upon to take Cabinet minutes, to act as secretary to several cabinet committees, and, when Hankey was away on war work, to deputise for him. It was a sign of the discomfort in Whitehall at the rise of Lloyd George that by promoting his fellow Welshman TJ, Sir Ernest Swinton, a fellow civil servant, believed that he had conjured up a disguised Bolshevik from the depths of a Welsh mine. Despite his socialistic tendencies, though, Davis was certainly no revolutionary communist. As E.L. Ellis wrote, he certainly hoped, looked, and perhaps sounded like an outsider in the higher reaches of Whitehall at that time. Utterly uninterested in clothes, he cherished a superannuated bowler hat until David Davis insisted that he should buy a new one. His speech, which to the end of his life was entirely without affectation, had a soft lilting music of its own, the English of an educated Welshman. He thought the attempt to obliterate a provincial accent misguided, an absurd artifice. In his politics, as Ellis wrote, his former earnest Calvinism had been transmuted into a mild agnosticism. His youthful political optimism had been tempered by experience, but not wholly surrendered. He was a Fabian socialist, a collectivist who retained his belief in liberal values. He was critical of capitalism, but completely opposed to Marxism and class war. His experiences had given him a sense of urgency for improving the lot of the poor. His answer? Education. It was, so he thought, a moralising agency that would transform society and protect democracy, whilst uplifting the least well-off. He was also a self-professed Welsh nationalist, though he didn't like rugby. But quite unlike its modern incarnation, he believed that this was entirely compatible with loyalty to Britain. And, as I shall come back to, he detested the predecessors of modern Welsh nationalistic politics. It was his left-wing sympathies and the links he had made over many years with figures in the Labour movement that served TJ well in his new role. His domestic focus centred on two issues. The first was labour relations. He had kept abreast a progressive opinion and was tasked with advising the Cabinet on the best ways to deal with the trade unions as they became more militant in the last years of the war. Secondly, his time in Ireland came in useful with the spread of unrest and the push for independence. Not only did he give his professional opinion on the government's position, but Lloyd George took him as secretary to the British delegation in the negotiations over the 1921 Anglo-Irish Treaty. The Irish were both impressed and perturbed by the fact that Lloyd George and Jones were able to talk about their positions openly in Welsh, but that no one else present could understand. David Davis had fallen out with Lloyd George in 1917, which TJ felt was over the top for his old friend, and he began to distance himself. From there, the relationship soured to the point that when Davis died in 1944, Jones's obituary in the Times was noted for its spite. Nevertheless, he continued to cooperate with Davis's two sisters and helped them to set up the Gregynog Press, named after the hall in Montgomeryshire where they lived, to promote Welsh culture. Under his chairmanship, it printed 42 high-quality, small-circulation books and established the Gregynog Music Festival, which hosted such famous names as Gustav Holst, Elgar and Vaughan Williams. The fall of Lloyd George in 1922 left the position of the Secretariat in question. The new Tory Prime Minister, Andrew Bonar Law, had little use for it, but his successor, Stanley Baldwin, saw its potential. With no clearly defined role, Baldwin set TJ to acting as his political secretary in all but name. This included writing his speeches and giving political advice, all of which fell outside the remit of a civil servant. The press picked up on this and the Secretariat began to be seen in a partisan light. So, when Ramsay MacDonald entered office in the first Labour government, it was treated with suspicion and under threat of abolition. What saved them, regardless of MacDonald's reservations, was the fact that it was undeniably the case that TJ was a disinterested actor and always made the alternative case to any argument a minister put forward, which was crucial in sectional politics. As it was, Jones played a part, inadvertently, in MacDonald's loss of office. His accurate cabinet minutes contradicted the Prime Minister's account of his role in the cabinet court case, in the Campbell court case, in which the government was accused of interfering in a criminal prosecution. The minutes showed that MacDonald had misled the House of Commons in saying that the cabinet had been unaware of the case. When added to the Zinoviev letter, this scandal led to MacDonald's resignation for not having the confidence of the Commons and the return of Stanley Baldwin in the resultant election. The 1924-29 Tory government saw TJ back in a more explicitly politicised role. He advised the new Prime Minister on the composition of his cabinet and, as he had in the war, became a vital link with the trade unions in the 1926 general strike. Jones's role was as an acceptable go-between with the ear of the Prime Minister, and though his politics were ostensibly supportive of the workers, he wrote many of Baldwin's most memorable speeches and brokered the deal that resolved the strike. As a result, Baldwin made him secretary to the new Committee of Social Research, which was to scientifically examine domestic issues. He remained in this position, though it was renamed the Economic Advisory Committee, under the second Labour government, but in reality it was MacDonald's attempt to sideline him. Having been a senior advisor to four prime ministers, it was an ignominious end to a remarkable frontline political career when he retired in 1930. He could have stayed on for another 5 years, if he so wished, but he had had enough of Whitehall, and when an American oil baron offered £2 million to good causes in Britain, he jumped at the chance to help set up the Pilgrim Trust, which continues to give grants to charities to this day. This was not the end of his extraordinary rags-to-riches story, though. still respected in Whitehall, he continued to be consulted on Welsh public appointments and honours, which earned him the unofficial nickname of Secretary of State for Wales, at a time when that position, of course, did not exist. And he continued with his political interests, though he had lost faith in the ability of politics to truly reform society as he hoped. He now called for devolution and a BBC Welsh service. He also maintained his friendship with Baldwin, and though he voted Labour in the 1935 general election, he wrote his friends election speeches. It was not all one way, though. Baldwin ignored his advice to bring Lloyd George back into government, an unrealistic proposal if TJ had seriously considered the animosity between Lloyd George and Baldwin's lieutenant, Neville Chamberlain. When it came to one of the biggest issues of the day, appeasement, TJ also showed a complete failure of judgment. Recognising Britain's weakness, he was determined to facilitate some kind of understanding to avoid war. In 1936, whilst in correspondence with the German ambassador, Ribbentrop, he attempted to arrange a meeting between Baldwin and Hitler. To Jones, this seemed to be a way to come to a permanent accommodation. However, Baldwin was uninterested. He rightly suspected that the German government was using TJ to gain the legitimacy of a state visit. But rather than agreeing with his friend, that same year Jones met Hitler twice, first alone and then in Lloyd George's much-publicised semi-state visit. Jones was convinced that Hitler was acting in good faith if only the British government could be open to renegotiating the Treaty of Versailles. This was in spite of the fact that he knew of Nazi brutality through the help he was giving privately to Jewish refugees trying to escape. And yet he did not believe that Britain could fight and win. Rather oddly, as he was a private citizen and not at the heart of politics anymore, he was denounced in the Daily Herald in April 1938 as the mystery man behind appeasement. The evidence for this was that he was a member of the Clifden set, named after the home of Lord and Lady Astor, who hosted parties that included Chamberlain and other leading appeasers. In reality, he was one of many supportive voices, and though he could still be influential, he was certainly not the driver behind appeasement. It is true that he had assumed Chamberlain would listen to him like Baldwin had, but the former was a very different man. In fact, the idea of a shadowy cabal of aristocrats directing British foreign policy from Lord Astor's sitting room was more likely to have been the fake news of its day, invented by the communist editor of the Week magazine, Claude Coburn. If nothing else, it was a ridiculous exaggeration. In any case, the truth was that he was not a deep foreign policy thinker. His interests had always been and remained domestic. His only real thoughts on foreign affairs were that, in a Palmerstonian vein, practicality trumped principle. By the 1938 Munich crisis, he had come round to believe that speeding up rearmament was vital. He offered his services to the Cabinet Office to see the crisis through when it was feared that it would lead to war. This was rebuked, and he concluded that if they were to accept the national humiliation of so-called peace in our time, then the government should at least speed up rearmament immediately to avoid falling into this situation again. On the domestic front, where his interest really lay, he was a lot more effective. In 1935, he established the Unemployment Assistance Board to take unemployment relief, in the modern parlance, out of politics. Though he did in fact want benefits to be reduced, in line with his belief in self-reliance, and was uncomfortable with the more radical solutions to employment, his secretaryship of the Pilgrim Trust, of which he later became trustee and president, saw him making its focus also on self-reliance and self-belief. These were only the latest iteration of his quite Victorian, nonconformist view of the world. In 1939, he was the founding member and deputy chairman of the Council for the Encouragement of Music and the Arts, which would later become the Arts Council. Most significantly, though, was his role in College Harlech. Its empty buildings now stand as a sad relic of TJ's passionate belief in the value of adult education. In 1927, he had established his residential education college almost single-handedly. He used his extensive contacts on both sides of the Atlantic to fundraise for its opening, which he did with ease, but soon found that this dried up, and he had to spend many years fighting to keep it afloat. By 1937, it was safe. 220 full-time students had passed through its doors, mainly manual workers, with a syllabus that Jones insisted promote individual responsibility. It was the physical embodiment of the value he placed in education. Though he had lost his faith, it was a sign of his enduring commitment to nonconformist principles by seeking to enrich society, safeguard against moral rootlessness, and prevent class warfare. As such, it was a deliberate alternative to London's Marxist-inspired Central Labour College. Jones extended the initiative in 1937 to New Battle Abbey in Scotland, and was already the secretary of the Astor-funded York Trust from 1934 and the Alfin Lloyd Jones Trust from 1933, both of which were to fund poor students. We can only speculate, but had he still been friends with David Davis, it is likely to have been the sort of initiative that he would have jumped on. After the outbreak of war, he continued to call for Lloyd George to be brought into government, though the former Prime Minister had other ideas, and he advised Sir Stafford Cripps in his rise to prominence in 1942, which involved his criticisms of Churchill. In the same year, he addressed the Cardiff Cymmeradorian Society in an address entitled "The Native Never Returns." It was significant in denouncing the rise of Welsh nationalism. Unlike the nationalism that he had espoused, he believed it was an attempt to set the clock back, divide the nation, and scapegoat England for the failure of Welsh politicians to improve the standards of the country as it stood. In the view of this internationalist and socialist, withdrawing from Britain was to retreat from the direction that the world was moving in. That aside, though, he had little to do with national politics from then on. Despite his advanced age, his energy never abated. In 1919, he had been disappointed to not be appointed principal of the university at Aberystwyth. In 1928, he had rejected a similar post at Cardiff because he believed that Aberystwyth could be the centre of reforms based on the ideas he was promoting in Harlech to the confederal structure of the University of Wales. He finally got the position he coveted in 1944, which he then held until 1954, a year before his death. And he relished in the company of the students and campaigning to ensure that in a world that had split the atom, the sciences did not now crowd out the humanities. In 1946, he also ensured that the new campus on Penglise Hill was built by fighting proposals by the Aberystwyth Corporation to compulsorily purchase the site to build housing. Supported by the National Library of Wales, he led a deputation to put a stop to it. He envisaged the new campus to be in keeping with the splendid aesthetic of the National Library. Visitors today can see that this did not quite go to plan. Within weeks of receiving this new distinction in Welsh cultural life, he was awarded the Medal of the Honourable Society of the Cymmeradorian. As his biographer put it, it was the ultimate mark of public recognition of distinction for Welshmen. Soon followed by his becoming a Companion of Honour, he had earned some of the most prestigious decorations in British national life. TJ's interests in his final years were not now narrowly provincial, though. Yes, he had stepped back from national politics, but he continued to engage in various activities. For instance, in 1946, he became a founding trustee of the Observer Trust, thanks to his friendship with the Astors, who owned the paper, and which also helped to get his son, Tristan, in as manager. And in 1951, he published the first biography of his old friend, David Lloyd George. However, by 1950, approaching 80 years of age, he was still remarkably active. What was successively diagnosed as lumbago, then sciatica, and finally fibrositis, rendered him housebound several times. It irritated a man of such frenetic activity, even though his books kept him company, and he was fortunate that his health was otherwise good. Right up to his death on the 15th of October 1955, he remained devoted to his work at the University, the National Library, the College Harlech, the Pilgrim Trust, and the Observer. It was a fitting end. In the preface of his book, A Diary with Letters, 1931-50, published in 1951, Jones wrote that, "Without owning thousands, I have found it possible to share in the control of other people's millions, and, as did Andrew Carnegie and more easily, I cherish the hope of dying a reasonably poor man amidst the blessings of the welfare state." His relative penury was just one of the many peculiarities about TJ. He was instinctively inclined to gradualist socialism, but a close friend of the defining interwar conservative Stanley Baldwin. He lost his faith, but regretted the decline of its values in society, and sought to promote them as much as possible. He was wedded to Welsh cultural and civic institutions, but despised the sort of nationalism that has become more commonplace since. He was intimately involved or a witness to every political event between 1916 and 1939, with privileged access to the corridors of power throughout, and yet he has remained relatively unknown. He was a working class lad, and yet the Prime Minister with whom he had the worst relations was the Labour Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald. Most striking of all, though, is that as son of the South Wales working classes, rose to become advisor to four prime ministers at a time when, in theory at least, the class distinctions were distinctly more rigid. As Ellis wrote, he personified the principles of public service and active citizenship. He did not seek wealth, and certainly didn't obtain any, or personal gain. This led to his making his anonymity almost a fetish, so that he could work behind the scenes to achieve meaningful change. His friend and colleague in Harlech, Ben Bowen Thompson, wrote in his entry for the Dictionary of Welsh Biography that though he had abandoned his intention of becoming a priest, he remained through his life a doer of the word, due to his exceptional drive and energy. His biographer's conclusion in 1992 holds strong. For historians, he remains one of the most honest, trustworthy public chroniclers in a notably dishonest political age. Despite MacDonald's reservations, he was widely seen to be a disinterested figure who challenged his political masters when needed. It kept him secure in Downing Street for 14 years, and he became a legend in the civil service during his lifetime. He was the personal repudiation of Sir Simon Jenkins' claims that the brightest and best Welsh leaders in the 20th century left and rarely returned. For though he gravitated towards the grandeur of the imperial capital, he always retained his ties and passion for Wales. I think it is best, then, to conclude with the words of his biographer. The fact is that there are no ugly skeletons in TJ's cupboard. In moral stature and aggregate achievement, he was something very like a great man, making up with Lloyd George and Aneurin Bevan the three greatest Welshmen in public life.